Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Displacement and Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Property, Stigma, and Invisibilization of Landless Fisherfolk in Bangladesh. I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for today, Enamul Majid Khan Siddiqui, who is an international development practitioner turned anti-colonial thinker, seeking answers to the questions around decolonizing environmental governance in the Global South, especially Bangladesh. Growing up in a forest village on the southeast coast of Bangladesh, which was once part of historic Arakan, he has seen the dispossession of natural resources from the marginalized communities firsthand. Welcome to the podcast, Enam.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to just start today's conversation with just asking you to talk about yourself and your background and the kind of work that you do and the activism that you've undertaken that's brought you into this work, please.
Thank you. You just did introduce me with my connection to the village that I grew up in. And that is a forest that has a lot of biodiversity. It includes elephants, it includes deers, hundreds of bird species, snakes, many other beings that I grew up with. And that had an impact on me in my childhood. And I had to get out of that village, as did many of my other fellows, because of economic and educational reasons, because that forest that we were living with was a wildlife sanctuary. I mean, it wasn't a wildlife sanctuary for ages. It was a fairly new thing that was introduced while I was a child. And before that, although it was like on paper by the British classified as a reserved forest, there was no like real impact on people's lives. People were able to cultivate rice in the valleys. They had a pretty much integrated life with the forest. But when the wildlife sanctuary was imposed and then conservation NGOs came in to protect the forest, eventually it became something that's seen as a crime, basically, to claim your rights to the forest. And when you detach people of their rights over the forest resources, water, everything, the economic life also dies out. So I was growing up in a situation when everybody was trying to go out of the village, especially if you can afford to have education outside. And that stayed with me. I kept moving from the village to the nearest city, which is Chittagong. And then again, like for the same reasons, to Dhaka later. And when I graduated from the University of Dhaka, by that time I was already practicing journalism. But as I said, like deep inside me, I did want to get back to something closer to the forest. So I wanted to pursue an environmental career. And I started working with this international environmental organization. And eventually I found out that I basically found out what happened to my people through that work by seeing how environmental conservation work actually works, how people lose their rights to their forests, to their waters, in the name of protecting environment. And it was a lot of blame put on the most marginalized communities, while the real harm to the environment was happening through much bigger reasons like industrialization and pollution, which were way beyond the control of forest dependent communities. And at one point of time, I sort of gave up that I didn't want to participate in the crime of dispossession. So I moved out of that, and then I started working for a humanitarian organization who was supporting the nature-dependent communities, especially river-dependent communities. And that's when my work with fisherfolk communities also started. In my work with the environmental organization, I was promoting heavy conservation-focused legislations. A lot of them had punitive measures. In my second chapter, when I was working from the humanitarian side, I was going against that. I was trying to bridge the perspectives of the fisherfolk and how harmful the laws and conservation measures were for their livelihoods, their human rights, where that became the focus of my work. And I continued that work even beyond my, like that role I was in. And when I started pursuing advanced academic work, like a PhD, I continued working on the issues of fisherfolk. That sort of remained with me because I could empathize, I could connect with what they were losing, because in my case, the forest is gone. Like I can never reclaim it. But if I can contribute to someone else not losing what they still have, I would very much keep doing that. That's what I do.
That's a really, really interesting story and a really interesting journey into your current work. And I'm fascinated by this discussion around the fisher folk. So you've been doing this work, obviously, for some time. So can you tell us a little bit more about what is going on there and what some of the vulnerabilities are that they face that you are also helping to support them on?
So it's a problem that has many faces. Of course, the fish ecosystem itself, it is declining. It's complex. There are many reasons for that. Of course, the first thing that people would usually blame, not people, governments, is overfishing. And that's simplified in a very peculiar way. They say, okay, we have 68,000 fishing vessels, artisanal and small-scale fisheries. And we have 256 industrial vessels, which also fish in the Bay of Bengal. Now, it sounds like, okay, 68,000 versus 256. Maybe these 256 do not have a big impact. But actually, when you use advanced technology and you're subsidized, these 246, 250 or like more industrial fishing ships, they do a lot more harm and they are not scrutinized. They are powerful people who own these vessels. But when it comes to the 68,000 people, these are like, of course, it's also complex, but these are like people who depend directly for their livelihoods. And for hundreds of years, the artisanal fisher folk, when they were fishing, the fisheries were not declining, whereas these industrial fishing vessels are relatively new, and you could sort of connect where this is coming from. Then heavy pollution from urbanization, industrialization. Nobody's talking about the impact of that. But the measures for conservation are focused on these artisanal fisher folk. And the main measure is fishing bans. So they are basically asked not to fish for different reasons, 22 days for hilsa breeding, then 8 months for the juvenile hilsa fish, which is the national fish of Bangladesh, to grow. And then you have 65 days to protect the marine fishing. Like, there is a long list. And eventually, the only days they are allowed to fish, you have cyclones coming in, floods, and then there are like non-government reasons, but natural reasons. But everybody knows which seasons they are talking about. Like, having your fishing bans in the good seasons and leaving the bad season, lean seasons, when you are not supposed to fish or you're not supposed to get fish. It's a passive aggressive way of asking people to completely give up fishing. And it's quite blatant, like in the projects and policies that government do, you would see these alternative livelihood paradigm where money goes into buying maybe other stuff like a rickshaw or a sewing machine, like something else that they are promoted to do instead of fishing, as if fishing is a crime. And talking about crime, if you look at like how they are criminalized, you would see thousands of arrests. You would see confiscation of fishing nets. You would see confiscation of fishing boats, fish nets being burnt, boats being burnt, and unfortunately, in recent times, several murders of fisher folk. Of course, it's done in the name of conflict and all, but when one side has guns and the other side has fishing nets and sticks, it's not really an equal fight. So it's complex, and also it's also built on existing forms of inequality. So when a fishing ban is going on, and you have someone very powerful employing fishers as laborers, that person never gets arrested. No harm comes to their lives. Whereas at the front, fisher folk have been reduced to laborers, as I said, and taking all the risks, be it from the police, be it from harsh environment, everything, every risk that comes with the job.
I mean, what you have talked about in this narrative is very disturbing, and clearly it builds on the already existing inequalities and it creates widespread impoverishment of vulnerable people already. Could you tell us a little bit about how they live and what the implications are of these different kinds of fishing bans and so forth?
We are frankly speaking about millions of fisher folk. And like in government data, it's like 1.6 million fisher folk in the country. But that's mostly the men, because women fisher folk are not that much acknowledged, even through the government process. So there is a gender disparity that I just talked about. But there are other disparities, like intersectionally. If you look at lower caste Hindu fisher folk, they are much more vulnerable than fisher folk who do fishing in addition to farming, who have land. So fisher folk who do not have land, more marginalized and more vulnerable. And among them, the women are more vulnerable. Now, I can give you an example. I work with a fishing community who are landless and they live in boats. And one of their communes is in Chaandpur, which is known as the capital of Hilsa fish, the national fish of Bangladesh. So it's at the center of attraction or attention. And these fisher folk, they fish along with their families. So they would have these small boats that they live in and another one that they use for fishing. And you would usually see a husband, a wife, one child maybe going for fishing together, or maybe two sisters fishing together. And they use very minimalistic tools. Like, for example, in Bangla, what we call borshi, like a fishing hook and line, or a very small net. Now, when Hilsa fish is breeding, or if the juvenile is growing, the kind of fishing equipment these people use, they cannot, like, even if they wanted to, they cannot catch a Hilsa fish. You need different sort of gears. But fishing ban impacts them also as well. Like whatever they are fishing, they are not allowed to fish. Now, if you have these consecutive like fishing bans again and again and again, these people become vulnerable, and they, because they don't have any other means, and also like they are a fish dependent, river dependent community, it's unfair to ask them to do it. Now, if they are going to the river to fish during a period where it's illegal to fish, it shouldn't be, but it is, then that makes them vulnerable to police, local elites, others who are in the rivers, like for example, people who are doing sand mining. And river is not necessarily a safe space, especially for a woman in our context, not even for men, but especially for women. And if you look at their boats and everything, it's very easy to sink. So, and they are like hand rowing it in most cases. And other people, maybe they are like, if you talk about police, they are coming with engine, not just engine boats, speed boats, like which, like just by passing through them, they can sink them. So there are inequalities that exist in multiple layers, and that makes these ex already vulnerable communities more vulnerable, and they would have to maintain a power relationship, like where they have to maybe bribe, they have to give extortion money, they have to give up a portion of their income, which is not fair. Or they just have to live in the coast and not go for fishing, which means like sometimes starvation or eating up whatever limited savings they have. And because they are a landless community, their savings are not like, it's not land or like something that can grow. It's potentially some ornaments that they have made of gold, because that's what they can carry. And at best, maybe the boat that they own. So we are not talking about a lot of things. So if they, and these are their capital. If they lose this capital because of these processes of like fishing bans and other things and forced starvation, that creates huge issues from a human rights lens, I would say.
So I just wanted to pick up on that point you made about landlessness. And I wanted to ask you how these questions around landlessness and the fact that these fisher folk have only their boats as their main assets, how that impacts their relationship to Chandpur as the city that you've been doing a lot of this work in.
So thank you for asking that. The community that I was talking about, they have been living right next to Chandpur city in the river of Dakatia, which is the main river of the city, for several decades. But they have never been really accepted as city dwellers. I mean, many of the city dwellers are much younger in this city compared to them, because people migrated from other parts of the country to the city, as it happens with growing cities. But those people would be immediately accepted as people of Chandpur. But the boat resident fisher folk, they are stigmatized. I mean, they are stigmatized for many reasons. Culturally, there are these inherited hates about them being lower class, or I would say sort of a casteism is there for sure. You would see that they don't get access to education or water, the mainstream facilities that the city dwellers use. They are not readily available. Like, things are changing lately, but after a lot of activism or voice raising, they did not even have their national identity cards. I'm not saying they are not citizens, because by constitution, anyone living in the country is a citizen. They have not even come from outside. They are people who have been here for ages. Now, the problem is that any service that you want to access as a citizen is dependent on that national identity card. And they do, and that national identity card is linked with your address, your permanent address, which is a land, which means someone who's landless, someone who lives in the rivers, do not have a way to access these services, which is pathetic, because Bangladesh is known as a country of rivers. And these people are not like aliens. If people knew that there are communities who live in water, and they should have thought about it when they were designing these processes. And when you think about solutions, like, okay, someone benevolent has come in the administration and wants to do something, their first solution is kick them away, kick them out of their rivers, send them to a land which is distant, and settle a farmland or something for them, which doesn't really work, because their way of living is tied to the river, but it's also tied to the city. Because part of their livelihood comes from the city when they do vendoring and other stuff, and even they sell their fish in the city. So them being considered as an integrated part of the city, a part of the citizenry, is something that we see doesn't happen. They don't have even their own representatives in the mainstream leadership. They have their own leadership. They have the shorthers and like majis who represent them within their own structure. But it's as if two communities are speaking to each other. The short there on behalf of the landless fisher folk is speaking with the city administrator, who is the other. So it's not your own representative, which bothers me a bit. But it is an urban question. And then the pollution that the city creates goes right through the river on which the fisher folk live, literally. And that pollution impacts them the most. The water that they consume is impacted. and the sanitation facilities are impacted. They don't have any sanitation facility whatsoever. And I was talking about development programs a bit. So there are, and you were talking about some vulnerabilities also.
I wanted to actually get into that discussion as well and talk about the kind of vulnerabilities that they face. And I think you made a really, really interesting point about the ways in which the government approaches a lot of these communities. And given a country like Bangladesh, where, you know, rivers are such a big part of the landscape, there's no thought given over to communities that might be living in them. And so the property system is landed rather than thinking about other ways of living. And, you know, it's fascinating to think about how a very particular imagination of where people should live or how they should be living then feeds into how they are made powerless in different ways and the vulnerabilities that they face. And I was going to ask you to elaborate a bit more on that, but also just tell us, what does the government do then? Do they displace them? What happens to them in the long run?
I wouldn't say the government in particular has any plan. You wouldn't find these communities reflected in any plans. It's individuals who pick up, if you like, because they are quite visible. And as social media is growing, people are looking at them. You would see influencers going there. And I have heard like fisher folk becoming very resistant to that as well. Like they are sort of annoyed. They have a private life. They don't want people to just go with a camera and like talk about their plights. And they see nothing happening out of that. The problem with government responses is, again, it's land-centric because they don't have a particular constituency in their planning process. It impacts. So, for example, if you think about when the rivers were co-opted, like they were taken over by the British colonials, they didn't just take the water itself. They kept the river banks, so which they made into like state property. There is this rule of like how much of the land in the riverbank belongs to the government before the private land starts. And anything that you want to do, like, for example, if you want to set up a toilet, maybe an administrator wants to do that. Now, he can do it only legally. Even someone who is doing a project from non-government organizations, they need this government clearances before they do it, especially if it involves a permanent structure like a toilet or a water pump. And they can only do it on lands which are either allocated by the government for that part of by kind of work, which is a very complex process, or on private lands which are leased out or bought. Now, the riverbanks are permanently, like you cannot do anything on it for the protection of the river. They would always be government land. And even the administrators cannot allocate it for something else other than maintenance of the river itself. So you would see people coming and going with money and they are not being able to set up anything. And whatever has been set up is considered temporary. Like even if you have a toilet or a water pump that I was talking about, that would be considered temporary. Similar to their own boats or any structure that they make. The problem happens when it comes to their own survival. So water and sanitation is part of survival, but home, especially when there's a cyclone or there's a flood, becomes very important. And we have to remember that these communities also have children. And the biggest problem is it's not a very big community. So it's a tiny part of the Chatput town. It's like about 300 families. So compared to like thousands of, like tens of thousands of people who live in a city like Chatput. So they are sort of minimalized. Like people don't see it as a major problem of the city. And then life and death are big issues. Even if it's a few hundred families, it does matter. So especially children, like they can fall in the river and die if you don't have a proper shelter. And they make these temporary shelters based on bamboo sticks and all, like very vulnerable. But even that is like on government lands. And they know that they are under the risk of eviction anytime, which makes it more difficult. And even the disaster management related plans are land centric. Like you would find shelters made for a village and they would look at, okay, how many households are there? You would not find shelters made for people who live on boats in the rivers. There is no response team for that. It's not simply there. If you look at other parts of Bangladesh, so for example, the Howrah region, which is known as a wetland region, you have these villages surrounded by water bodies. wetlands. There is a response system there. You would see water ambulances and other stuff. But Chaatpur or like riverine areas, they are not known as that. Like the assumption is everybody has a land, everybody lives in a village or a city. And that's why I say like it's stigma, but it's also invisibilization. Everybody knows they exist, but they sort of forget them. They don't see them when it comes to planning and investment as fellow citizens, which is contributing to the fact that it's continuing for decades without much change.
You've outlined a lot of the ways in which the government invisibilizes the fisher folk through legislation and then through planning, and it erases them from the landscape because they're not seen as being landed. And this also leads to their displacement and their relocation and so forth. But I imagine that that's one part of the story. And I'd love to hear from you about what the fisher folk do to resist these incredibly oppressive practices.
Thank you. I mean, even if it's a small community of maybe 260 to 300 families, they are not homogenous. They are individuals, they are families. Everybody would resist or reimagine things in their own ways. And as I sometimes also say, places, even if they don't belong to us, we have this sense of belongingness, be it a river, be it a city that doesn't want us. We find these connections. And one of the ways that I have seen this community resist is trying to claim their rights over the place that they think they belong to, and they want that place to belong to them legally. So they are advocating with the local councillors and others and trying to find ways to get legal rights over that land. There is a risk that that can still be taken over because once you have the papers, that paper can be disowned or sold, and there will be pressure because of the price of the land and everything. But that's a process that's going on. The second thing that I see is integration. Like the city is also not homogenous. There are people who would acknowledge the presence of the fisher folk. You would see these marital relationships with the city dwellers both ways, like women getting married into the commune, then women of the commune getting married elsewhere. Some of the kids, children who have got education and are considering other professions. So they also keep their connections with the community. So that's another process, the natural process. And of course, there is a third process, which is out-migration, like going to other places, which is not always, that's not a strategy. That's, I would say, is coping in the long sense. And there is this other discussion that the city is sort of trying to promote is having a village made elsewhere outside of the Chaatpur town and relocating them. But that is being also resisted as an idea because the community simply would not accept anything that's imposed on them. But it is a story of ongoing resistance.
I wanted to ask you as a closing question to reflect on the story and offer us your thoughts on sort of the bigger questions and what you think displacement scholars should think about from this kind of work as well.
So I'm not particularly sure what the attention of displacement scholars are at right now. However, in general, what I have seen is that attentions are often shed on sensational topics, like when you have a big cyclone taking thousands, I hope not lives, maybe houses, it still gets attention. Even the humanitarians respond to those big, you know, doable, attractive projects as humanitarian response to disasters. But stories like these, they get invisibilized, especially if it happens over a long period of time, over decades. And that's the story of every vulnerable community who's facing climate change as well. When you have these, what they call slow onset events, impacts of temperature, impacts of water systems, pollutions, erosion, over a long period of time, they are creating huge impact, which gets invisibilized because they're happening bits by bits every day, and we sort of miss it. The same thing applies to displacement. When displacement happens in smaller doses, We don't notice it. When hundreds of thousands of families get displaced, we notice it. If you talk about nearby communities of Rohingyas, when that was happening in 10 families a day, nobody noticed. When 100,000 people arrived, a million arrived, then the world took notice. And that would also happen with climate-related displacements. And the most vulnerable communities who are already impacted by these other stigmas, invisibilization, and other forms of oppression, they would also face that oppression of climate change. And I hope displacement scholars would also think about that.
You're absolutely right that invariably the focus, certainly from the humanitarian perspective, is on episodic violence and looking at these sort of grand episodes of displacement. It's the sort of everyday forms of destruction and everyday forms of displacement that get overlooked. There's such a disconnect between understanding how the everyday and the episodic come together. The people who are impacted by the episodic events and the everyday events are very often the same. They're the same people who are incredibly vulnerable in the first instance and are often ignored by different groups of people, including humanitarians. And it's really important to think about how the attention also needs to be given to these everyday forms of violence, rather than just focusing on just the episodic events when possibly things it's too late in many cases, and that, you know, many of these communities will have been suffering for many years as well. I mean, these kinds of questions around the vulnerabilities that different communities face are so layered onto each other, and it's unfortunate that that's not often seen by humanitarians and by other groups of people that are often trying to support them.
And agree more.
Thank you so much for your time with us today, and I really appreciate it, and for bringing this fantastic perspective that brings together this very textured narrative around environment and around displacement and around land rights. And it's just been really, really interesting to talk with you through this. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you for including me in the discussion.